Questions to the Prime Minister. Question number one, Mr. Roy Hughes.
Number one, sir.
Mr. Speaker, sir, this morning I presided at a meeting of the Cabinet and had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in this House, I shall be having further meetings later today.
Mr. Roy Hughes.
In the course of her busy schedule, will the Prime Minister pause to consider the desperately long hospital waiting lists in Gwent, which, combined with the recent Scrooge-like cuts in Social Security benefits, would seem to illustrate a complete lack of concern for the plight of ordinary people. Could I point out to her, or perhaps she needs an astrologer after all, that it was these sort of factors which led to the virtual extermination of the Conservative Party in Newport at the local elections last Thursday?
Mr. Speaker, well, with regard to the health service, first, there have been two specific programmes directly related to getting down waiting lists, which have been very successful. Second, there have not been cuts in the health service. Indeed, there's nearly £2 billion more allocated to the health service this year than last. And thirdly, there have also been increases in Social Security. Again, another £2 billion allocated to Social Security over and above previous years. None of this could have been done unless my right honourable friend, the Chancellor, had run the economy in such a way as to get a higher standard of living and a higher standard of social services.
Sir Marcus Fox!
Would my right honourable friend take time today to consider the implications of the gains made by the Conservative Party last week on the Bradford Metropolitan District Council? Yeah. Plus the defection this week of a Labour councillor who has joined us. Thus making us the largest group on the council. Is this not a sign that people in the inner cities are looking to us to a better future by controlling government locally and nationally?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I join my honourable friend in congratulating the people of Bradford for their wisdom. The results give Bradford new hope and a new chance, and the prosperity is spreading widely all over the country, including to the Bradford area.
Mr. William Ross!
Number two, sir.
I refer the honourable gentleman to the reply which I gave some moments ago.
Mr. William Ross!
Does the Prime Minister recall that a few days ago she told the House that she would seek reassurances from the government of the Irish Republic that they would not back out of their responsibilities in regard to terrorism under the Anglo-Irish Agreement? Does she further recall that she told the House that the people of Northern Ireland would have their rights maintained under the Anglo-Irish Agreement and that the government of the Irish Republic had accepted that? Did a right honourable friend, the Secretary of State, bring back such assurances after his private meeting with Mr. Hockey last week?
Mr. Speaker, the honourable member has, in fact, I believe, quoted correctly what I said. The Anglo-Irish Agreement was an agreement signed by both governments, an agreement registered with the United Nations, and must, in fact, continue to be upheld. That, I believe, is now understood on both sides of the border.
Sir Heseltine.
Would my right honourable friend reflect today on the fact that it is 40 years to this very day since a Labour minister announced that Britain would have its own independent atomic deterrent? And would she further reflect upon the remarkable contrast between what now must be seen as the giants of the post-war Labour government and the political and parliamentary pygmies that have replaced them?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. In those days, there was virtually no difference between two sides of the House on the importance of defence and the nuclear deterrent. What a pity there is such a difference now.
Sir David Blunkett.
In view of the government's unwillingness to use the 1975 Industry Act or other powers to intervene to protect round trees from the proposed takeover by Nestles, would the honourable lady confirm that she, in fact, is not willing to intervene to protect any industry, service or national asset from international predators, and that it is this side of the House that would protect workers and the people of Britain and not the Conservative government.
Mr. Speaker, I will confirm what my right honourable friend pointed out yesterday, that when we receive a bid, it has to be dealt with in accordance with the law passed through this House and the results of debates approved by this House. That law is that the opinion of the Office of Fair Trading must be obtained, and that the Secretary of State must wait to receive that opinion before making up his mind as to whether such a bid should be referred to the Monopolies and Mergers Committee. After that has been received, he will decide, and then if he decides to refer it, the matter can be dealt with under competition rules or under public interest. But I hope the Honourable Member is not suggesting that we can, in fact, disobey the law of the land.
Mr. William McRae.
The Prime Minister take it from me that the vast majority of the people throughout the United Kingdom deplore the unwarranted attacks on the members of the SAS who carried out an effective measure in Gibraltar in defence of the innocent. And will the Prime Minister take it from me that there is rather disgust that there seems to be some members both inside and outside this House who are more concerned about those who are terrorists than the welfare of our security forces?
Speaker, I join with the Honourable Gentleman in saying how thankful we are for the excellent services of all members of the security services in protecting us from terrorism.
Robert Waring.
Number three, sir.
I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the reply which I gave some moments ago.
Waring.
Mr. Speaker, following the disclosures yesterday from the National Security Archive in Washington of Colonel Oliver North's memorandums, can the Prime Minister give an assurance to this House, a categorical assurance, that her government has never either directly or indirectly, say via the CIA or her friend Colonel Pinochet in Chile, facilitated the supply of arms to the contra-terrorists in Nicaragua?
Mr. Speaker, I have given the answer so many times. I will repeat it again. I can say categorically that we have not agreed to supply blowpipe, and we have not supplied blowpipe to the Contras.
Eric Forth.
Has my right honourable friend yet sent her congratulations to the President of France on his re-election? Has my right honourable friend noticed that the leaders of government of two of the great democracies of this world, namely France and the United States, will reach the end of their elected terms of office in their late 70s. Is she determined not to be outdone in this matter?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mr. Speaker, I have sent a message of congratulations to the President of France. I have spoken to him, and we hope to arrange a meeting before probably the Toronto summit to discuss important matters. I have also noted the matters to which my honourable friend referred, and I assure him that at all times I shall take a balanced view of these matters.
Neil Kinnock.
Mr. Speaker, the pound has risen against the Deutschmark again. Is the Prime Minister content to see it go on rising?
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman will complain when the pound goes up and when the pound goes down. The Chancellor will in fact run the economy in such a way that we combine low inflation with good economic growth. He's been extremely successful in that objective, an objective and an achievement which totally eluded the opposition.
It's pity, Mr. Speaker, that the Prime Minister couldn't answer that question. Can she answer this one? Does she recall the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying 2 weeks ago, when the pound was lower than it is now, "I do not want to see the exchange rate appreciate further. It would be unsustainable and damaging for business and industry." Does she agree with that?
Mr. Speaker, I agree that the Chancellor runs the economy extremely well. With low inflation, which honourable members opposite were never able to do, with excellent growth, giving all people in this country a much higher standard of living.
That's all very interesting, Mr. Speaker. Can she give us a straight answer? Does the Prime Minister agree with her Chancellor of the Exchequer?
Yes, sir. We shall continue to run the economy. below inflation.
Order.
Excellent growth, which gives a high standard of living, a high
order.
Standard of social services. And it is that total picture which counts. What a pity the Right Honourable Gentleman can't understand the answers or the economics.
Mr. Richard Holt.
May I draw my Right Honourable Friend's attention to the situation today where the Labour Party in total disarray in Langbath and Reading.
Prime Minister, well, you may be, but the Prime Minister is not responsible for that.
Will my Right Honourable Friend send a message of support today to the new Conservative mayor of the borough of Langbath, the Labour administration having fallen apart with two Labour members now voting with the Conservatives?
I will join my honourable friend in doing just that and join him in congratulating the mayor.
Tamdeo!
As the honourable gentleman knows, it is not the practice to comment on lobby briefings.
Mr. Tamdeo,
how come that in the course of many, many speeches, many, many broadcasts, and many, many press statements, not once has the truthfulness of the Prime Minister and of Mr. Ingham about the events of January 1986 been endorsed either by the Right Honourable Gentleman, the member for Richmond, or the giant from Henley?
Mr. Speaker, the details have been given many, many times in this House, and I have nothing further to add to them.
Mr. Cash.
My Right Honourable Friend note today that the Governor's...
Or order. I think the Honourable Gentleman has not looked at the order paper. This is a definitive question. Mr. David Winnick.
Five. Number five.
I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the reply which I gave some moments ago.
Mr. Winnick.
Is the reason why no replacement was made when Lord Whitelaw resigned as Deputy Prime Minister is that she already has a Deputy Prime Minister, namely her Chief Press Secretary, Mr. Ingham. And while she clearly, Mr. Speaker, has many difficulties in getting on with her Foreign Secretary and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is it really desirable that the Chief Press Secretary should have more influence in policy matters than any member of her, than any of her Cabinet colleagues?
The Honourable Member must be hard put to it for a question to ask that one. I note that he cannot find a single thing to criticise in the economy or way the country is run. How very revealing.
Mr. Maxwell Hislop.
If my Right Honourable Friend today, as First Lord of the Treasury, receives a request that the Bank of England Export Credit Guarantee Department should underwrite any deposits required by aspirants for the job of leader of the Social and Liberal Democrat, would she please resist it as firmly as she can?
I shall take note of my honourable friend's sentiments.
Mr. Alan Beath.
I refer the honourable gentleman to the reply which I gave some moments ago.
Beath.
How long will it be before those pensioners who are now paying increased rents but hope to benefit from the government's about turn on the social security changes know for certain that they will benefit, and how long will it be before they get the money?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think the honourable member, who I hope has an interesting week ahead, will already have in fact received a letter from the Department of Health and Social Security giving details of both a free post and a free phone where any inquiries can be made. He will know that a special unit has been set up in Glasgow to deal with each of these matters, and he will also know the place to which they can apply if they have any queries.
Mr. Robin Squire.
Following my Right Honourable Friend's visit to Docklands this week, will she underline from the dispatch box the outstanding achievements in terms of jobs, housing and transport system which that combination of private and public funding has achieved?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I went down yesterday. The result of the London Docklands Corporation is quite outstanding. It's outstanding in the amount of investment that has been made there. Something like £4 billion of private sector investments have been secured. It's outstanding in the number of jobs which that area is providing. There are now 36,000 jobs in Docklands, and the number employed in Docklands have fallen by 15%. It's outstanding in community support, something like £17 million spent on community support. It's outstanding in increased road and rail improvements, outstanding in housing, both in the private sector, and also one notes that a quarter of purchasers of new homes on LDC sites were former local council tenants. An outstanding achievement in every way for the record of private enterprise and the imagination of this government and the way in which the whole matter has been administered by the first two chairmen and their deputy chairman.
Business questions, Mr. Neil Kinnock.